Welcome to the Lowy Institute today. I'm Natasha Kassam. I'm a research fellow here at the Institute, and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land we've gathered on and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Now, the human tragedy that is the coronavirus, also known as COVID-19 now, emerged in December in Wuhan, Hubei, in China. It's difficult to comprehend just how quickly this virus and its implications have spread throughout the world. For some context, on the 6th of January, just 6 weeks ago, Chinese authorities were saying that there were 59 cases. 2 weeks later, that number was 300, and 2 weeks after that, it was 15,000. Today, there are reported 79,000 cases around the world. 2,800 people have lost their lives, and the vast majority of infections do remain within China, but we've seen numbers rising at a worrying pace in Korea, Japan, Iran, Italy, and in other countries. While we won't be talking about the science today, which is rapidly evolving, we have an excellent panel to take us through the political and economic implications of this epidemic in China, in Australia, and in the world. I'm very pleased to introduce to my right Richard Yetsenga, the chief economist and head of research at ANZ, who has previously been at HSBC and Deutsche Bank in Hong Kong. We have Philippa Jones, who is a regulatory and trade policy specialist and the founder of China Policy, a strategic advisory firm based in Beijing. And then Richard McGregor is a senior fellow here at the Lowy Institute and an author of many acclaimed books, including The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers, and Xi Jinping, The Backlash. Now, I think we should start with the implications in China. And Richard, I think the question everyone here wants to know the answer to is, the economic downturn post-SARS was short and sharp. How do you expect the crisis to impact Chinese GDP growth in 2020 and beyond?
I don't think it's just about the economic impact, but as we go through this, how people feel about the sense of control they have about understanding this. And I think one of the issues about SARS was it was the first issue of its kind that we'd really had to deal with on a regional or even global basis. And so levels of uncertainty were very, very high. Now we look back at SARS and say, well, we understand there was this V-shaped recovery and that gives us some comfort. I'm just cautious about taking that too far. I mean, if you think about the history of emerging market crises, after every set of crises, lots of studies are done about what caused the crisis and how to prevent the next one. And then we all sit around confident that we understand emerging market crises, and yet you still have the next one that looks slightly different in a way that is important enough for the system to be tested. And even if you look at this current problem, after SARS, some early warning signals were set up globally so that we'd have better information transmission around diseases that look to be multiplying quickly. That system, it turns out, doesn't deal well with new diseases because we don't yet understand how quickly they multiply. So we solved the problems of the last crisis, but not this one. I think that said, we should presume there is some sort of V-shaped cycle here. We have, you know, some cessation of production for some period of time and then a bounce back. The first quarter will be negative in China. There's no doubt about that. It's just a question of how deep. Probably brings annual growth down to maybe with a three in front of it, potentially even lower. And then we bounce back. I think, though, the issue which has really come through and actually was already there is about access to information in the Chinese economy because you know, already there was this bifurcation, for instance, in the way credit was allocated, the state sector getting free credit, the private sector really struggling. Ultimately, what you need for the private sector to be an engine of growth is free access to transparent information. And I think that's probably the economic question which has arisen in this period.
Okay, so we might not have learned all of the economic lessons we wanted to learn from SARS. But Philippa, how do you see the way domestically the healthcare system has responded this time? Did they learn lessons from SARS? How are we seeing that play out in China?
Well, it's very interesting what Richard has just said about the response globally. It was very similar in China. After the SARS outbreak, 30 billion renminbi were funneled into a response program in China. And the central government understood the problems of reporting and they made sure that this new system meant that the reporting went straight from the county level up to the CDC. Would have been fine, and it has worked. And we've seen recently there's been quite a few outbreaks that have been contained. There was recently bubonic plague in Mongolia. What happened with this one? It was a new one. And the system was not set up to deal with emerging threats. And so it didn't pick this up. And it wasn't until, I think, the 22nd of January that they actually worked out a way of bringing that in. And this has been noted by the policy community over the last few years, and they keep raising it, you know, we need to do something to the system to deal with emerging threats. And, well, they didn't. So that's what happened.
Okay, so in healthcare terms, I think you say the system wasn't set up to deal with emerging threats, but I think, Richard, we could probably say that the system itself, I think, in dealing with threats has a very particular playbook. So how are you seeing the way the party is responding to this crisis, and what does it mean for governance at the centre at the moment?
Well, I guess there's the health threat and there's the political threat. And Philip has touched on, you know, the management of the health system. In terms of the politics of it, it is, you know, once again, as Richard Wan says about SARS, it's, you know, China's a very different country to 2003. The transport system, you know, the country's much more interconnected, therefore the risk of transmission is much greater. The structure of the economy is much more different. Now it's much more dominated by private firms who don't have such easy access to capital in terms of that V-shaped recovery. And, of course, we have a strongman leader. The leader of the chairman of everything, Xi Jinping. So what actually happened in Wuhan? We know a couple of things. We know this was an extremely sensitive time of the year. In Wuhan, they were holding their local people's congresses to prepare to send their delegations to the National People's Congress in March. That's now been delayed, by the way, as Philippa reminded me. That's the first time the National People's Congress has been delayed since the Cultural Revolution. So that's quite a signal they're sending about the seriousness of this. But Wuhan had their local congresses and they were preparing for Lunar New Year, a city of 11 million people, which is a rail sea or Yangtze River and air hub. So something happened. They panicked. We don't know whether they reported it up or by what channel. Sadly, in China, we don't have royal commissions, and we're not going to find out later exactly what happened. But the narrative, one of these striking things, I think, so far, in SARS, once they got on top of it, they had a single person, Wang Qishan, who ruthlessly prosecuted the measures needed to contain it. This time, surprisingly for Xi Jinping, the narrative has been very muddled. First, he came out on, I think, the 20th of January, 22nd, issued a statement, Wuhan was locked down. Later, he sort of came out and said, well, actually, I knew about this on January 7, and I instructed the Politburo to do something about it. That's at a time when we weren't getting any official announcement at all. Initially, his approach seemed to be like Mao, Chairman Mao and Deng Xiaoping would have done, which is to drift into the background and only re-emerge at a strategic time. That kind of narrative has now been thrown out. He had a sort of conference call with 170,000 officials the other day to deliver a message. We don't know what the long-term impact of this is on the economy, the health system, or the political system, but certainly we can talk about foreign policy in a second, but certainly Xi's standing as a leader has been tarnished. I don't think it's quite China's Chernobyl. It's a good phrase, but I don't think we're there yet. But it's in terms of his leadership, I think it tarnishes it, and we'll see if there's any longer-term impacts later.
And Philippa, what do you think that means in terms of public confidence in the system? We've had numerous crises in the past over high-speed train crashes and melamine scandals. You know, how does this compare in terms of the way people are feeling, you think?
I think the one it most closely compares to is the melamine crisis. The Wenchuan earthquake was a understandable, if regrettable, and very unfortunate, but it was a big, great, big train crash. The Sichuan earthquake was much more of a act of God. It was a natural disaster. So despite the recrimination and the Dofu schools and all of that. But where this is similar, I feel, to the melamine crisis.
In 2008, explain what it is.
So in 2008, it was discovered that milk was being adulterated with melamine. It was, again, it took a long time for it to get out. It was actually the New Zealanders who forced the issue because Fonterra was in a partnership with Ely, who was, it was Ely or Mungo, one of the two big companies. And what happened was, again, it was very slow to come out. It was very, the response of government was not to be transparent, not to take charge of the situation. In the end, there were 350,000 babies that were sickened, numerous, and I think much more than ever hit the headlines, young children died. They're vulnerable. In the same way here, we've got vulnerable people dying at the hands of what, in theoretical terms, we could very often say is recreant group of a policy community, a government community that should be putting the health and well-being of the general public first and foremost. So what I see here is, again, there is possibly over time, it will, the major impact will be the fact that so many very vulnerable people died. And what I also wanted to mention about melamine and why melamine is an interesting and apposite comparison is that, particularly in Australia, we see the repercussions of the melamine crisis still happening. I talk to investment asset management and investment advisors that one of the main things that they're always interested in is milk powder. Now, nowhere in the world is milk powder regarded as gold as it is in China. And this extraordinary focus on making sure that you have milk powder that is not made in China goes right back to the melamine crisis. Also, the government has spent masses of time, money, resources on trying to build a Chinese dairy industry so that it can say that China produces high-quality, safe milk and baby formula. But it doesn't sell as well as Australia and New Zealand.
If that's the legacy of the melamine crisis in the minds of Chinese consumers, what do you think the legacy will be of this current episode?
What I'm thinking about is not so much the legacy, of course, is in terms of what's happened with milk powder. We haven't got a similar legacy, but we have got the legacy in that what happened with melamine was it was about vulnerable children. Here we've got an enormous number of people who are dying, and one of the things, the questions I think that is going to be asked in Wuhan is what Richard has just been saying about how the outbreak unfurled in Wuhan and what were they doing? Would it have been different? You know, we can't say from hindsight whether it was going to be any different, but everybody will be asking that question. Should this number of people have died? But not only should that number of people have died, but how come our livelihoods have all been affected? So what we don't know at the moment, and one of the things we're probably going to be talking about, is how the economy is getting back to work. Now, for a lot of these people who we're talking about in the private sector, are they going to get back to work? One of the things that also I would say here is that the Chinese government, in changing its development model, is saying, well, we're going to be focused on consumption. You know, China is going to. But will there be will the consumers have the money to consume?
And we'll come to that in just a minute. But before we do, Richard, I just wanted to ask you, that in terms of that legacy, you said, you know, it's unclear what it means in terms of the way Xi Jinping feels. Certainly in recent weeks, we've seen, I think, unprecedented levels of online grief over the death of a whistleblower doctor and people calling for freedom of expression at that basic level, asking these questions about whether a more transparent system could have prevented so many of these deaths. So do you see people on the ground and the way they feel about the party changing in any way?
Well, it's very hard to say. I think Xi Jinping's first impulse will be more control, not less control. Many people would take the opposite lesson out of this, that you should have much more open transmission of information because that is a sort of a safety valve, a preventative measure and the like. Certainly you've got the usual dichotomy in China. The centre is going to blame the provinces or the city. I think that's pretty unfair because in Wuhan, the Wuhan or the Hubei government cannot announce a sort of pandemic themselves, you know, because that's an announcement that has a global implications. Of course, they have to consult the centre.
And Wuhan mayor pointed that out.
The Wuhan mayor pointed that out. I think it's actually a Chinese law and quite a sensible one. But we don't really know what they told the centre and whether they told them just keep it calm for the moment. On Xi Jinping generally, and this is a terribly generalised dichotomy, but I think there's a lot of elite criticism and dislike of Xi Jinping, but I think more broadly speaking, you'd probably say he's a popular leader. Now, that might be because they can control the propaganda and all of that, but generally speaking, the economy's growing. People, you know, China's position in the world is growing, maybe up until now, so there's pride there. But most of all, the anti-corruption campaign, and that obviously helps Xi Jinping as well, that's very popular. But if we come back to what Philippa is talking about, ordinary people being made to pay the price for officials' mistakes in a very direct and visceral fashion. Now, whether that translates into a political movement to open up at all is a moot point. I doubt it. But I think there would be a lot of pressure from the intellectuals and the technocrats and the like who are critics of Xi Jinping to take that lesson from this crisis, whether he does or not, is difficult to know.
In terms of people who have already had to pay a price in that way and now looking at an economy that, as you say, is not going to grow, seems that small and medium enterprises will be hit the hardest. What do you think we can see happening in terms of getting the system back online? Stimulus, tax relief, what's going to come next?
So I think the playbook actually is already there, and certainly it does seem like the smaller end of town is affected more because, in a sense, we have this SARS playbook. It does seem like larger businesses, regulators, governments, not just in China but elsewhere, understand this is a temporary shock. If we can all be a bit mature and manage our way through it, then it doesn't have to leave a huge permanent legacy in its wake, although, of course, there will be some cost. But obviously, as you get down to smaller enterprise, they have less liquidity buffers, more difficulty managing through that. And I think the stimulus playbook is already there. Forbearance on whatever is within government control. Forbearance on power prices, social security contributions, medical contributions, tax relief, rent relief, anything which helps the cash flow problems in the short term. It doesn't make a lot of sense for the government to stump up and spend a lot of money if you're telling people that they can't go to work or they can't leave their house. Doesn't do a lot of good for the government to announce an intention to spend more money. And in fact, even if there's some question about the depth of the V kind of and what the severity is like, ultimately we should come out of this within months or that sort of time period. Macro policy is likely to be having its biggest impact as you're already coming out of it. So you need policy effects now, which are at a firm level.
Yes.
Xi Jinping is committed to trying to reach this year's target, which has to be around 6%. Or maybe 5.9% to reach the bigger target of doubling the size of the economy from 2010 to 2020. So that probably helps the V-shaped recovery theory.
Pretty tough target.
It's a pretty tough target.
Yeah. We'll see.
Absolutely. And of course, with official numbers in China, there are always questions to be asked.
One of the things that I would add from our sort of granular daily monitoring is that the constant refrain that we see coming from central policy departments about this is not about, it's not so much about now, but right through the last year, about this is, we're not going to stimulate the economy, we're going to manage it better. And so what we've seen in terms of stimulus, if you like, in recent months, is much more looking at what we call smart stimulus. So if we want to build something, we want to build 5G towers because that's going to help us develop our the telecommunications and our internet economy. But it's not, and in terms of logistics and communications, it's about roads, not about airports.
So then you could make an argument, I think, that in many ways SARS was the beginning of e-commerce in China. Is there any upside in your view for China in economic terms?
Well, yeah, exactly. What is happening at the moment is the organisations that are really out there creating labour and being on the front foot are the Baidu, Tencent, Alibaba, all of the other startups that are looking at technical solutions. There's a lot of fun out there about how they're doing it. You know, I read one about somebody with a contactless delivery. So he got onto an app and got a contactless delivery for his lunch, and the driver came and put it outside the door. So, but there was an app for it. So as you probably know, there's an app for everything in China. But one of the areas that we're looking at is particularly at MedTech, particularly looking at EdTech. So, of course, there's been a very, very big push in education online. It's an area that I think Australia should be seeing where it can help. One of the things that is interesting is China has a major focus on rolling out the internet through regional China, and it has been part of the rural revitalization campaign. But what we're finding in terms of EdTech is that students are finding it extremely difficult to get online and to get the amount of bandwidth that they need. But certainly it's in those areas where we're seeing an uptick. We're also, of course, from the government end, seeing an uptick on their focus on AI and on anything that is tech-related. And, of course, this also ties into the issues with the US. So look at the decoupling issues. China is focused on developing as a technological centre itself. It wants to be to develop its all the strategic emerging industries, and this is just another push that it's putting along in that direction. And also we're seeing a lot of emergency funds going into tech development.
So this might be a good moment then to think about some of those global implications. And Richard, I've been surprised to see in the last few weeks that markets haven't necessarily responded as you might expect to this outbreak, although we've then seen that shift this week. What are the markets telling us, and is there a rebound that you describe this V built into that response?
I think there is some element of that, but some markets have responded. It depends where you look. Certainly up until the weekend, the equity and credit markets had been very well behaved, but US bond yields are a smidgen away from all-time lows. Australian bond yields are basically at all-time lows, you know, well below 1%. The Aussie dollar's at post-financial crisis lows. The Singapore dollar's trading at 140 against the US dollar. So some asset classes have moved a lot. I think the things that have held credit and equity in probably are three. One is this idea that this will be V, and I can look through it. I think the second issue is the fall in interest rates has been really important. Investment is an opportunity cost game. You've got to hold something, and the faster interest rates fall, the more that helps to buffer other asset classes. And I think also, and I get this sense particularly from investors in Europe and the US, that many advanced economies are actually going to handle this in relatively good shape, particularly the US. I think people expect the US for this to largely have no effect on the US economy, and I think that last piece is going to be tested over the next month. I mean, given the linkages in global supply chains, given how big China is, given how many countries this has now spread to, the US must be affected in a way that I think you'll be able to see in the macro data. I think that's going to give us a bit more market adjustment, yeah.
Okay, and Richard, in terms of foreign policy, what do you think? Are we going to see some countries are demonstrating that they want to go to China as soon as possible, or others going to be punished for the restrictions that they've put to China?
So I'm not. I wonder about punishment. I mean, I think in the early stages of this, the China was dividing a little bit up into friends and enemies. You're being friendly to us. You're not putting on severe travel restrictions. Enemies, you know, you have put on severe travel restrictions. That's breaking down now, I think. Or even countries like Russia has, I think, closed its borders to Chinese. You know, when countries like Australia did that, China made it very clear it was not happy with that. When Russia did it, of course, they sort of really said nothing and, you know, but they won't be, you know, so you can't divide it so easy now because so many countries are taking much tougher measures. On the general issue of China, I think one of the interesting things is in recent years, you know, it's a very much a sort of theme of coverage these days about the hopeless, sclerotic Western democracies, you know. Look at Donald Trump, the implosion of the US political system, Brexit, Bojo, you know, Canberra is the coup capital of the world. What a mess we are. And at the same time, China has been, you know, stable, a single strong leader, cleverly sort of getting around all the obstacles in the global system, Belt and Road Initiative, all the dominoes falling in their behaviour. A lot of talk about the export of the China model. I don't really think that's the case, by the way. You can't really export the China model, but certainly China as an example of a successful alternative to the US and Western democracies. This sort of muddies the water a bit on that, I think. People will look at China and wonder if it is such a wonderful system that works. That's going to be one impact of it. I think certainly relations with the US haven't been helped. Once again, of course, in America there's confusing signals with Donald Trump tweeting friendship and his Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross saying, great, we can get some jobs off China out of this. So there's been a mixed message there, but it's not good for that. It plays into the theme of decoupling, or at least hedging your bets in the global supply chain. The Japanese, I think, for 10, 20 years have had a China plus one strategy. I think everybody's going to have a China plus one strategy now, so it plays into that. That's more of a bifurcated world. In terms of Australia, it was interesting watching Q&A last night with Mr. Wang Xining. He was not nearly as critical of Australia as I thought he might be. He was actually marginally complimentary. You know, if China accuses Australia of overreaction, at the same time they're sort of locking down in some sort of residential control system 80 million or 760 million people. I mean, who's overreacting? And maybe they're overreacting in the right way, but... So not sure that it's been too bad. Our relations are already very poor, not getting better. The diplomatic calendar for the year now has been much delayed. All sorts of trips that people might have made are all pushed back 3-4 months. I don't know that we've got much further to fall in bilateral relations, but I don't think this is particularly bad. Finally, I'll just say one more thing. The country that China has praised the most is Japan. Xi Jinping is meant to go there in April. I think that will be about the first state visit by a Chinese leader, if I remember this correctly, for at least 10 years, maybe much, much longer. So that's a big event they're trying to preserve. But I think the way the virus is unfolding in Japan now, there's a bit of a backlash there. It'll be very interesting to see whether that trip comes off.
Some of those measures that could be described as an overreaction, perhaps not in China, have been praised by the World Health Organization in terms of their handling of the crisis. And Philippa, I wanted to ask you, how much is that a reflection of Beijing's response to this health crisis, even if it was better late than never, or how much of it is that multilateral institutions feel compelled to keep the Chinese government on side?
Well, the World Health Organization is, unfortunately for all of us, really between a rock and a hard place. It is dramatically underfunded. It has a mandate to look after the health of the global population. And so many of the funding channels are not open to it. I was looking this morning at what was happening with their funding. On this particular issue, early on in February, they they proposed a strategic global strategic response and said what seemed to be a very modest amount, that they needed about $675 million. So I looked this morning to see how are they doing, how is the world responding? Is this really a global problem that they want the World Health Organization to help them with, and to see that they're not even talking about the 670 odd million now. They're talking about what they need over the next couple of months. So in order to really focus on what they need to do to get through the next couple of months, they're looking at 60 million odd. They've been pledged 30, they're still looking for 30, but they've actually received 1.2 million. So nobody wants to fund the World Health Organization, but what is the alternative?
And I'll come to the audience in just a moment, but briefly, Richard, I wanted to ask you about the implications here in Australia. We've had so much discussion of the higher education sector, but presumably any of this downturn has particular implications given the level of entanglement between Australian industry and China.
Unquestionably, one of the legacies. I mean, Richard spoke about the Japan's China Plus One strategy. Australia, of course, has had a China Plus China strategy. So there are a few sectors, I'm sure, which will be looking at themselves around that. But I think the broader issue actually is strategic, and this WHO example, I think, is a good one. I mean, Ian Bremmer, the kind of a US political commentator, uses this term G0. We're not in a G20 world or a G7 world, we're in a G0 world where there's really an absence of global leadership. And if you think about this current event, the WHO announces an international medical emergency, but says that travel restrictions are not required. China had already started locking down itself internally where there were infections. On the 1st of February, the US says, well, we're going to impose some travel restrictions. China remonstrates. Some other countries follow. Other countries are now, more countries are still following. Other countries have now imposed domestic travel restrictions of their own. The WHO is having trouble raising money when it seems to be the only global organisation that can manage this. The managing director of the IMF, I think a night or two ago, said global coordination is absolutely essential to resolving this issue as smoothly as possible, and yet everything about this has been a lack of global coordination and trust. So the institutions that we're used to are still there, but they're not operating well because at a country level, the level of trust has diminished. And I think this G0 world really has been brought into stark relief, and I think it's going to be a defining legacy, at least recognition of that is going to be a defining legacy of this episode, unfortunately.
Well, on that uplifting note, if you'd like to put up your hands if you have a question for our panel, we have mics. My colleagues will come round with a mic. Please introduce yourself and I'll ask you to try to keep your questions brief.
You're talking about the V-lift. Isn't that predicated on a vaccine for this thing? It's looking to me like a world pandemic, and I'm not sure we as a species are highly evolved enough to cooperate to solve it.
And well, evolved enough. But, the medical questions you raise, obviously, I don't understand. The history of these things seems to be we resolve them one way or another. I do agree that my sense of it is the big question, and we talk about these things in terms which can sound cavalier, so please excuse me. To me, the worrying thing is not the death rate, but the worrying thing is the infection rate. If a billion people get something which has a very small mortality rate, the human cost is extremely large. And so far what we seem to be learning is the infection rate is very high. It's very easily transmittable. So if you're asking me, am I worried that the V is very deep and quite elongated? Yeah, of course I'm worried about that. Yeah.
I'd say one point on that. In SARS, for example, and this is also not good news, I think 55% of the deaths were outside China. That might be Hong Kong in particular. So far with this, it's 95% inside China, but that's just at a moment when it's picking up pace in Iran, Italy, South Korea and the like. So, yeah.
And absolutely, the rate of infection in China is starting to flatline, but the outside of China rate is just on an exponential track right this moment. We had another question.
Hi, I'm Meriden Burrell from KPMG's Geopolitics Hub. Thank you for a very interesting panel. I'm just interested in finding out what you might think from anyone on the panel, what this might mean for phase one of the US-China trade deal, inverted commas, and the broader US-China relationship flowing on from that. Thank you.
I think that's all the big buying commitments in the first phase one deal, in the phase one deal. The Chinese, I think, have already said pretty early on this is going to be difficult, which is a way of saying it's not going to happen. I think that most people are a little bit sceptical you'd ever get phase two this year in any case. But phase one, you know, the big purchases for energy, for soybeans, for agricultural goods, China just won't need them. There was always a question whether it ever did need them and whether it ever, you know, whether it would follow through with those commitments. But I think I'm pretty sure now that the commitments for this year won't be met. Now, what does that mean in the context of US election year? I guess it depends on how competitive the race is between Trump and Bernie Sanders or whomever he's competing against. And, you know, Trump already has paid a massive amount of money, I think double or triple what has paid a massive amount of money to farmers, double or triple what they paid for the auto bailout in 2008-09. So it could get a little bit edgy towards the end of the year during the campaign.
If I could add something, I would say that the one area that they probably will be buying quite a lot is going to be in agriculture. Not necessarily all the soybeans that the American farmers would like to be selling, but we're certainly picking up that they're very, very concerned about agricultural supply. So
that's a different fertilizer type.
No, no, it's not that. It's actually, well, one of the things that's happening at the moment is Hubei is one of the centers of chicken production, and the chickens weren't getting fed, and so that Tyson's will be doing very well out of that. But also, it's just, you know, the feeling that you get when every day there you're getting directives on spring planting and getting things done, and the focus on agriculture seems to be a little bit disproportionate, giving us the impression that they're particularly worried about how they're going to get through.
Thank you. David Olson from the Australia-China Business Council. It's quite clear from what's going on at the moment that our vulnerability to China and our dependencies is playing out quite rapidly. I'd be interested just from the panel, from an economic and political perspective, are there any upsides in this? You know, what is our China plus one strategy? Can we use this to our advantage to rebuild, reset political relationships, to rebuild our economic relationship in a different way to what we've been doing in the past?
Tough to find a silver lining in my view, but Philippa?
Yeah, one of the things that I was looking at recently is China is having problems with its supply, big problems with its supply chain. So it is going to be looking more and more to diversify its own production. So it's going to be wanting to set up production around the world so that their clients are not going to be just buying things from China, so they're going to be buying things from around the world. So I would have thought that on a smaller scale, there will be more companies looking to invest overseas and to set up production plants overseas.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that's a good point. I think there's, for all manner of reasons, we might get more Chinese investment in Australia. Maybe that's in agriculture, maybe, frankly, in property. We might get more people wanting to come here to live or to have PR status as an insurance policy, because this will be a shock for many people. You know, compared to SARS, the Chinese middle class is so much bigger, and their expectation is for, you know, clean water, healthy food, et cetera, all the sorts of things that have sort of been tarnished by this scandal. In terms of China plus one, you know, Australia's economic relationship with China is very different from other countries. As you well know, you know, we do business sort of with China, not in China. You know, apart from CSL and a couple of companies, we don't have large factories in China, so there's not that sort of offset. Our offset is developing other markets for what we sell, And of course, that's not so easy because no matter how much anybody might think that India is going to take over, it's really simply not as dynamic a place as China. I do hope, though, particularly for the university sector, that, you know, one of the great ironies of this is, you know, many people in Australia have been politicians, have been very worried about China taking out some form of economic retaliation against Australia to signal their political displeasure with us. Of course, we're getting a test run now of what might happen if they did that. And the funny thing about that, the greatest advocate for the Chinese students coming to Australia have actually been the Chinese government, trying to get over the obstacles that the Australian government has put up. I don't blame the Australian government for doing that, by the way. But it's a good, healthy, maybe overly healthy, in other words, a big shock to us to see if we can recalibrate. And, of course, the big issue is whether the relationships, for example, in tourism, I think if I get these figures right, there's about 90 direct flights from China a week to Sydney, maybe 164 to Australia. After this is over, the airports don't expect those flights to bounce back. In other words, we'll go from about 90 to 60 in Sydney. So there's going to be an ongoing shock in that respect.
So maybe just to extend that a little bit, China is about 20% of global GDP, but it accounts for nearly 40% of global GDP growth. We can't avoid China as the most important final consumer. There's a question about how you deliver into that, and if your supply chain strategy has been focused on China, of course this throws up questions around that, like it does for the higher education sector in Australia. And I think globally, the way supply chains have set themselves up over the past couple of decades in this really golden period of globalisation doesn't seem consistent with the geopolitical world we now face. They seem too long and too complicated. I was reading a piece over the weekend. The average motor vehicle apparently has 3,000 parts. Only 10% of those parts end up in the final factory. The rest comes through the supply chain. There is no way you can know where all of the first countries you buy from, where they source all their stuff from. So I think, you know, if there is a risk management task here, it's managing people's supply chains. That seems to me it's going to be a big shift over the next few years.
One of the things we see there in China is that within provinces now they are trying to restrict their supply chains and not have interprovincial supply chains. You know, it's just...
My name is Jack Wu. I'm a student of Development Studies at Macquarie University. My question is... regarding the military movement of China during the outbreak of coronavirus. In more details, there is opinion that China may actually launch an attack on Taiwan in order to distract their people from the perceived failure of the government in dealing with the coronavirus outbreak. So how do you comment on such opinion?
I'm going to put my neck out here and say definitely not. If you want to interrupt the supply chain, that's the way to do it, by the way, because Taiwan is so important to that. I don't think that's going to happen in 5 years, even, to be honest. In terms of distractions, I mean, there's been a bit of foreign distractions in finger-pointing at foreigners, evil, nasty foreigners and all that sort of thing, but that's the sort of froth of on the top of the propaganda wave sort of thing. I think the real focus is to get things going again inside China, to, you know, get the economy up and humming, to get that V-shaped recovery taking shape and the like, and then they can look outwards and see whether they might or might not want to settle scores, because we can talk about the China settling scores with its critics, but of course, this has just brought home the perils or the dangers or the benefits of globalization and managing all of that. So I don't expect a significant foreign policy change or military change as a result in the short term.
But then stirring up that kind of perhaps anti-Taiwan sentiment is perhaps a part of a broader strategy to use nationalism and other distractions. To what extent do you think that part of the messaging campaign has been effective?
Well, let me ask you, as a Taiwan person, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of complaints of Taiwan, quite rightly, not having access to the WHO, not having access to proper health information, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think during the course of this there's been a particular focus by Beijing on what Taiwan's up to.
I wouldn't say focus, but there's certainly been, you would think there would be capacity constraints at the moment in China, but there's been time to fly aircraft in, across the median line in the Taiwan Strait. There's been purchasing, large purchases of body armour for the military, which would be aimed at signalling towards Taiwan, I would think. So,
yeah, I just think it's signalling. I just think the, and maybe I'm, I don't want to be Pollyanna, but I think military options to settle the Taiwan issue, even within 5 years, are kind of a disaster, unless something happens like Taiwan independence or something. I just don't see it.
Just wait for the mic. Thank you.
Thank you. Rory Robertson, Westpac Group. I wonder if anyone on the panel would like to hazard a guess whether the travel ban of people coming directly from China will be removed before, say, new travel bans were introduced, say, from Korea. I mean, given the jump in recent days from, you know, being a China-specific thing to having spread elsewhere.
Well, sequencing, I don't know about the sequencing, but the federal government's obviously dying to ease the travel ban from China. It's the last thing they want in terms of tourism and students. You can see they gave a signal by allowing high school students to come. There's a lot of work going on about once it is lifted, how to actually get students here because there's so many fewer flights. So I don't know about the sequencing, but I think we'll get some lifting of those restrictions. You know, you can exclude Hubei province or Zhejiang, where it's also, or Harbin, where the disease is centred. You can, you know, pick and choose certain places, but I think it will start to happen soon from China. Whether they'll put similar bans on South Korea and Japan, where they just lifted the level of notice, I doubt that.
3%, what's your thoughts on the flow-on impact on Australian GDP growth?
Look, the first quarter will have a big impact. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Half of foreign students are from China. We know the tourism impact will be large. Our internal data suggests retail spend at the major East Coast airports is down about 27%. So there's going to be a big impact. I mean, when we crunched the numbers a few weeks ago, we were getting a number for the first quarter of minus 0.1. Now, when the economy is only travelling at 1.5 to 2%, that's quite a hit. And so even if we bounce back to normal after that, for the year number, you're still looking at something below 2 for Australia. Hopefully it's over, you know, in months, and then we're talking about an effect that's confined to 2020, and hopefully in 2021 we can get back to normal.
So it's more of a U-shape rather than a
V-shape? Well, it's a bit of alphabet soup. I mean, It depends on the length of the issue as to whether there's a technical recession or not. I mean, obviously, if you restrict activity and then it returns to normal, you can get quite a sharp rebound in growth. So provided that happens by March or April at the latest, if it happens too late in the second quarter, then it might not have time to really filter through and starts to hit you in Q3. So a technical recession is not an impossibility. I'm not sure that's the major thing I'd be looking at, though.
What I might add there, in China, the analysis at the moment is saying that if it's March, April and we can get a bounce back, we'll be okay. If it's May, June, it's going to be real, have a massive impact. And that's what they are most concerned about.
I mean, obviously, the longer it goes on, the more bankruptcies you get, the more supply chain, you know, genuine breakdowns you get, the more people have tried to source things from other places. And so the more you change things fundamentally. Yeah.
Thanks. Dominic Ma. Richard One mentioned liquidity. That's Richard on my right. mentioned liquidity as one of the challenges for the economic side of this. Have any of the panel heard any moves from the government about fixing? You talked about small businesses mainly, but I'm thinking more about household liquidity. Is there any talk from the government about directly cash injecting to households in the sort of similar manner to the Australian government during the global financial crisis?
As in here?
I mean in China.
Oh, as in China. I haven't...
Yeah, I would say it's much more... Well, the onus is on the companies not to sack people and to carry on paying them. So we haven't seen anything about actually directly recompensing or injecting money into the households, but certainly massive pressure on the companies, and then all of the other things that, you know, luckily at companies like us who suffer from having a 40% markup or so on our salary bills, it's different.
It's an interesting thought, though. I mean, because how do you distribute that? You could simply send 1,000 kwai to everybody's mobile phone or something, couldn't you?
Very easily done.
It's not like sending a cheque to a household here or
you'll
something.
You'll spend it on anything they can get home delivered. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why Alibaba's, the 10 cents share price has rocketed Alibaba's way down, isn't it? Mm. Yeah, anyway, sorry.
How to distribute money to the Chinese people, because a lot of Chinese people, as far as I know, don't even have access to a bank account. That's why they brought in this social credit system to try and, like help people get access to credit. If the mobile networks haven't been rolled out, a lot of people in rural areas wouldn't have access to mobile phones, I would assume, either. So
the mobile networks, is they're perfectly good for WeChat and payments. They're just not so good for online learning, where you need much more bandwidth.
In terms of getting credit to people, more people probably have access to money through their phone than a traditional bank account.
Absolutely. It's made a massive difference in China. Everybody, and this is one of the big changes in rural China, because now everybody has access to buy and sell over their phone. So it's a big impact. One of the things I was going to say, what you're much more likely to see is not so much that Dom was asking about the government directly financing households or giving them money. You're much more likely to see the big platforms offering very, very cheap loans or even funding them. This is where the fintech differences are in China. Much of the finances is run through the big internet companies, and they have massive liquidity, so they have money to spend.
I think this household question will stay with us long after this crisis has passed, because in fact, if you think about the Chinese growth model, investment as a share of GDP is tapped out and is now falling. The corporate sector's tapped out with debt over 200% of GDP. The augmented level of public debt, the IMF says, is 80% of GDP. Exports are clearly more difficult growth driver. So really the structural driver of Chinese growth needs to be raise household income and lower the household savings rate. Well, it's difficult to see how this episode does anything but encourage households to save even more. So that challenge is going to be the other thing, I think, which really comes up over the next couple of years. Yep.
Right, we have time for just one more, I think.
Thank you. I'm Yaling from Media. I just want to add one more question for Richard. Because since the outbreak of the epidemic, we can see many analyses about the impact to the economic development, and some of the analysis even probably like contradictory. Some people argue that the internet economy, the e-commerce, will have a big opportunity since people have to use the electronic or online platform to continue their consumption, while we can see some traditional industries like the export, the travel, they suffer quite a lot from this crisis. So in your opinion, after the outbreak of the epidemic, what kind of industry might benefit from this disaster, probably?
That's a very good question, and you've probably summarised the key points well. I suppose I'd separate between the immediate response to the crisis and what might happen more structurally. Certainly, as you say, if you're quarantined, the fact you can consume digital services makes that a very different proposition than even 2003 when we went through the SARS epidemic. And more structurally, I think, anything you can do using technology to simplify your supply chains. You know, as we've discussed, the world does seem overly complicated from a supply chain perspective, so I think that will probably continue to be a feature. The challenge for China, though, though it's very much at the forefront of the technology revolution, I mean, if you think about an Australian example, the resource sector might be doing fantastically well, but the overall economy is not doing fantastically well. So China might have this fantastic tech story, and it does look like it's at the forefront, but actually, how is China going to adjust domestically to that, and can it adjust in ways that distribute that wealth and income a little bit more evenly? I think that's probably China's biggest challenge.
Well, everybody, thank you so much for coming today, and please join me in thanking this wonderful panel that has spent time with us today. I do think that Richard said something earlier about how we can sound cavalier, and often in this line of work, it is our job to focus on the political and economic costs of these kinds of crises, but we shouldn't overlook the human costs of some of these tragedies. In this case, thousands of people are sick or have died, millions under travel restrictions, people have lost their families, lost their livelihoods. It's hard for us to grasp, I think, being so far away, but one thing that we've learned from globalization and messy supply chains is viruses have no borders, and Australia so far has been pretty safe. But there's obviously a lot of interest in this topic, and I know there are a lot more questions we'd like to ask. We'll have a few more events coming up here at the Lowy Institute. Dr. James Renwick, Australia's independent national security legislation monitor, will be talking about what are the right encryption laws for Australia here. And on the 10th of March, we'll be launching Professor Rory Medcalf's book on the contest for the Indo-Pacific and why China won't map the future. So please sign up at our website for those events, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.